listening to another Netcast production brought to you by the Fancy Pants Gangsters at fancypantsgangsters.com. Because those who can, do. Those who cannot, do it on the internet.
Hey, this is Sammy from the Fourth Rights.
Hey, we're Chester Bay.
We're John Wayne and the Pain.
Hi, this is your boss, smooth gal, Maddie Ruthless.
Hi, we're the Drop Steppers.
Yo, this is King Django, and you're listening to the Flyover Sky Show.
Flyover Sky Show.
Flyover Sky Show.
Flyover Sky Show.
Flyover Sky Show. And Fancy Pants Gangsters.
Fancy Pants Gangsters.
Fancy Pants Gangsters.
FancyPantsGangsters.com. Yo, what's up with the Fancy Pants?
Bernie Rhodes, now it's known, Archer!
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Flyover Ska Show, brought to you by the Fancy Pants Gangsters Podcast Network at fancypantsgangsters.com and MN Ska, Minnesota's ska community at mnska.com. I'm your host, Courtney Close, and we got to mention our sponsor here. We got to talk about our friends over at Copycats Media. You hear me talking about these guys all the time, so you probably know by now that they've got CD and DVD manufacturing, design services, in-house printing and packaging. They did the work for the new Prize Fighters album. They did the new work for or the work for the MN Ska mixtape. So you know that they put out good quality products. And they still got the special Flyover Ska deal. So if you act now, you can get 100 11x17 full color posters for free if you mention the Flyover Ska Show. So just go over and check them out at copycatsmedia.com. All right, well, we've got a great show today. We've got on the line here, author of Ska in Oral History. We've got Heather Augustine on the line. Heather, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks, Courtney. I'm happy to be here.
So I've got this book, and I've just finished it. I just recently blew through it. We were talking offline. I found myself getting my car worked on for about 4 or 5 hours the other afternoon. And so what better to do but to read all about the stories of the traditional ska and the two-tone ska and all the waves that were that are involved with the genre. So,
well, I hope it made that a little less painful for you, Courtney.
Well, it really did because
good.
it was quite expensive and it was a long wait. So the book.
Well, here to help.
Now, this book, how did this all begin? Or can you maybe give our listeners kind of a summary? What exactly makes up this this book?
Well, you know what? I started this book a really long time ago in 1996. I started interviewing some of the ska pioneers, and I was living in Chicago for about 10 years at the time in the mid to late 90s, and from like 94 on. You know, it was a really popular time for ska. There were bands coming through every weekend. There were 5 bands on every bill. You know, you'd have Parka Kings and Mephiscopheles and Eclectics, and it was just the Pilfers. Everybody was coming through. That was on the Moon Label or Jump Up. And so I was going to all these shows and having a great time and, you know, saw the Toasters practically every month or, you know, whenever they would come through. And I just loved the music, and I wasn't finding any information really about it. I would go on the Internet, which was kind of a new medium at that time.
Sure,
it was very... You know, yeah, there was like a couple FAQs, and that would be about it, you know, linking to somebody's AOL account or something. And
the good old days.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there was really nothing out there. And then any books that I could find were really about reggae, and they treated ska like, you know, the wicked stepchild and, you know, kind of gave birth to reggae, but then it just, you know, wasn't treated properly. So I thought, well, ska is obviously, it has enough value as a genre by itself. It led to reggae, but it also led to plenty of other things, two-tone and third wave and all kinds of great stuff. So I thought that there has to be more to this music than is being said about it right now. So I set out to interview people. When they would come through, I'd get permission from the band managers, or I'd talk to the artists, and they'd say, yeah, come on back. You know, it's a very DIY kind of music. So they'd say, come on backstage at the show. I'll give you a photo pass, and, you know, you can take pictures of us. You can talk to us after the show. And for every one person I would talk to, they'd give me five more numbers. Oh, you have to talk to this person. You have to talk to this person. And it just really grew. People loved to tell their stories. They were happy to have somebody finally listen to, you know, what they wanted to say. And it kind of grew from there. It ended up where I had this box of 30 cassette tapes, you know, micro cassette tapes. And it became so daunting that I just stuck it in I let it sit in a box in storage for a while.
Was the aim to write a book, or at the beginning, so that was always the focus?
That was always my aim. I had just completed a master's degree in writing in 96 and wanted to have a project, and this was something I loved. I was really digging my teeth into it, and then it just became so big. You know, I let it sit in a box for a while. After a couple of years of interviewing, it was like, where do I go with this? You know, it's just really huge. I didn't want to do a bad job.
Right.
So, you know, life kind of happened. I got married, I had kids, and all that happened. And then I went to a writer's retreat, and it inspired me. I thought, I'm going to pull this back out, because people started dying. You know, Roland Alfonso, who I interviewed, he died, and Judge Dredd died, and Laurel Aiken died. I thought, this is not fair. You know, they were so generous to talk to me for, you know, an hour or 45 minutes, and this is not fair to them. I can't do this to them. So I pulled it back out. I re-interviewed people that I had already interviewed. I interviewed a whole slew of new people, and I put it together.
So the writer's retreat, and when did the, when was the flame ignited? Like, what year?
That was about 3 years ago. It was about 3 years ago. It was my 35th birthday. I went to a writer's retreat, and I thought, well, you know, I didn't have an expectation, but coming out of that, I was like, I'm going to do this. I'm not going to give up. I'm not going to let this thing die, you know. And plus, at that point, I became a newspaper reporter, so which is what I've done for the past, I don't know, 8 years or so. And so I now was equipped with the skills to be able to handle these interviews. I couldn't have done it then.
Sure.
I didn't know what to do with these things. But now I'm used to taking interviews. I mean, I do it daily. I take interviews and I weave them into a narrative, into a story. And so now I finally had the skills to be able to do something with it.
Well, yeah, absolutely. You. I'm glad that you started back when you did. Obviously, because these people are mortals. Like people like you mentioned, like Judge Dredd and Laurel Aiken. These people were dying. So I'm really, really glad that even though you weren't equipped with maybe all of the know-how to put together this book back then, that you still had the material that you could,
right,
you know, come back to it and
right,
make a finished version.
Yeah, and you know, part of me is like, you know, it's like Schindler, you know, it's like, oh, if I could have interviewed, you know, Desmond Dekker, if I just could have interviewed, you know, tons of people before they died, and there's plenty of people that I could still interview, so I think that I didn't interview, so mm-hmm. I think, you know, there's still potential for even more beyond this, because for every story is a history. It's just a version of history. So I certainly could talk to, you know, new people, and there were lots of people I missed.
You know, there are some people that are not in the book, but, you know, going through this book, there are so many people that you did interview and so many stories that, I mean, I learned a lot just by reading.
Good.
Yeah, by reading the book.
Oh, I'm so glad. I'm so glad to hear that. You know, when it came to the two-tone era, I knew most of those guys were still around, and I knew I had to, except for the Body Snatchers, you know, if I could go get Rhoda, you know, that would be great. I regret not getting them in there. But other than that, I think I pretty much hit all those guys, all the two-tone guys.
Yeah, it does seem like there's a lot of two-tone people, but even for dummies like me, I didn't know a whole lot about the history. And I know that, you know, it's probably the traditional ska and reggae from Jamaica. That is probably the most words have been written about that. However, I guess in the grand scheme of things, I'm pretty new to this. I kind of got into ska and reggae back in the late 90s, so I feel like I'm a little late to the game.
No, it's okay. You know, I think most people are in that boat, you know, unless you're like 70 years old, you know, you wouldn't have listened to the Skatalites back in the day and stuff. And for most people, that is how they were introduced to the Skatalites, is through the two-tone era, I think, most of the people in our generation. And I think even if you do know about the Skatalites and you do know about Jamaican, you know, ska history, and you know about the big producers and the sound systems and the dances, there's still so much new material in this because it is through the eyes of the musicians themselves. So you're going to hear, you know, Lester Sterling talk about his memories of seeing Rita Marley come into the studio when they're practicing. And you're going to hear Millicent Todd, who's Patsy of Derek and Patsy duo fame, talk about things, and we have never heard her speak, because until the Legends of Ska concert that Brad Klein, a good Minneapolis comrade, until he put together that Legends of Ska concert in 2002, we hadn't seen her since the 60s in Jamaica. She came to America, she worked in a hospital, people here didn't know about her former life. She kept it a secret. And so this is the first time that she speaks, other than, you know, to Brad. So Millie Small, I mean, we haven't heard from her since her, you know, My Boy Lollipop days. So even if you do know a lot about Jamaican ska history, there's new stuff in here.
Yeah, well, I found that that stuff about Patsy Dodd, I mean, that was amazing. That, because what I thought was very interesting is back when you had all these Jamaican artists, they were, I don't know how to put it, confident. They were very confident in their ways. And,
yeah.
And she was so much the opposite. Like, she enjoyed what she did, but she moved on. She moved to an entirely different life and left it all behind.
Right. And she doesn't mince words. When she talks about her memories of it, you're being very kind and diplomatic, but she doesn't, you know, she says, I mean, blatantly, she comes right out. She says they were great musicians. They were just plain rude people also. They didn't have any respect for anyone. That I couldn't handle. And that's why she left. I mean, we know the reputation these guys have. We know Prince Buster can be a little tough, you know, but we have respect and we appreciate and we love his music. It's another thing to be in business with these people. I can only imagine as a female 15-year-old girl, it couldn't have been easy.
Well, and then she's being approached by essentially, like, you know, a strange man saying, hey, I want you to sing on this record. I mean, could you imagine that happening now?
I know. Knocking on the gate
right
to her door, saying, come sing with me. Yeah, that had to be a little, yeah.
I'm pretty sure that the authorities would be called if you were to approach a 15-year-old girl and you didn't know and say, come to my studio.
yeah. And she was tough. She was tough, too. She's like, why are you here? And she lived right next to Prince Buster, so she's got some interesting stories to tell. I love talking to her. But, you know, and some people, when I talk to them now, like, well, Lynn Tate, he was another person I talked to who died about 1 month after I talked to him. Very kind of skeptical still, you know, what do you want? What are you going to do with this? You know, kind of skeptical because of where they came from. Anybody who's seen the movie, The Harder They Come, with Jimmy Cliff, the classic, knows that it's a time when people were being exploited for their skills. And so there's still that kind of edge. Most people weren't that way. Most people that I talked to were very, you know, freely wanting to tell their story, and they, you know, the ska community is a very loving community, very friendly. But then there's another side of it, too, that persists from the early days. And I think it makes people just a little on edge. And I think that Patsy learned that, and that's why she left.
It's very fascinating because we live, you know, in a different country, different style, different environment of like music in general. So I just think it's wild that there were people, you know, like Lynn Tate, that were a little skeptical, and you can tell when you read some of these stories firsthand, you can kind of get that sense that they want to make sure that their story is heard, but they also want to make sure that their words aren't twisted used against them.
Yeah, exactly. And there's even some of them that didn't cooperate, shall we say, because they didn't want their words used without being given money for it.
Oh.
and I don't do that. And I don't do that because that would taint the story. That would taint the story because then that wouldn't be the truth. I would be more favorable to them knowing that I, you know, paid them and that I have to make sure that it's worth, you know, it would just change the story. So I don't do that. So as a result, there's a couple people who are missing after they had freely given me their interviews, because I won't do that. I just don't. So that's unfortunate too, but that's, again, a throwback to the old era. You know, it's a business. It's all about making money, and it's their talent and their story, and so they feel that they should be compensated for it. I understand. I getcha. But I feel compensation comes in many forms.
Oh, right. Absolutely. And I just think it's pretty bizarre. I mean, and especially nowadays, you know, when I talk to reggae and ska bands from today, they are bending over backwards. They want me to talk to them. They want their words out there. Because it's such an underground music. I mean, it always has been, but it's especially now. If they don't come on, you know, radio shows, or they don't get, you know, exposure, no one's gonna know who they are.
Right. And you know, I tried to explain that a little bit to some people because I mean, who am I? You know, I'm not gonna do any favors for some of the bigger names. But I am introducing, hopefully, is my aim with this book, is introducing ska to a new audience, too. Sure, it's for the people who love it, who are going to seek it out. But it's also because it's published by McFarland, which is an academic press. It's being put in university libraries and is being studied in music departments. And so it's hitting a whole new audience of music scholars and hopefully will go down in its proper place in music history.
Well, yeah, and this definitely, I could see this being used as sort of maybe required material for, you know, if you were going to be looking at that sort of like Jamaican music. I would love to take a course at like a university and be told, okay, you got to read Heather Augustine's book, you know. Because,
well, how funny, Courtney. I would love that too. but I think if you're studying any kind of world music, any kind of indigenous music, I mean, certainly, you know, pop music today comes from R&B, and ska came from R&B to a large degree. And so I think it could be required reading for many different kind of music classes. But, you know, and even if it is just placed in, a university library and, you know, somebody someday down the road picks it up as part of a term paper or whatever, you know, it's hitting a new audience. It's maybe converting new people to this great music that I'm so passionate about, and then I've done my job.
I'm just glad that it's documented, you know, in such a way. I know there are other books that touch more on reggae, but this is, it's always... And I think we're kind of cut from the same fabric here on this, Heather. I think we both are fans of hearing the stories directly from the source and letting them tell the story as opposed to someone interpreting what happened and kind of laying it out.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's exactly why I chose this format. Because, like I said before, I mean, who am I? I've never been to Jamaica. I'm a 4'11" white girl that lives in Indiana. I mean, who the heck am I? What do I know about this? So I'm just a conduit. I'm very passionate about this music. I have been for a long time. And I can bring that to the table. But what everybody else can bring to the table is their whole life. And I just wanted to make sure that that was heard. And so what I did is, I almost used all of the interviews that these people gave me and then wove them into a narrative so that it's an interesting story. And then you get all of the bits and pieces in between so that you're not missing any of the gaps and saying, wait a minute, where did this happen from? Or why was Mento, even part of the music? So I put all that in there so that you kind of can, it reads more like a narrative than a history book, like a boring text, a history text, or I didn't want it to be, this song charted number one in this year and the saxophone was played by this person. I didn't want it to be like that. There's enough of those books out there. You can find that on Wikipedia. I wanted this to be a fun read.
Yeah, well, and it definitely is, and it does flow very much like a narrative. So for those who aren't, so heavy into the music and its history, can easily pick it up and really just travel down the path that ska forged. I mean, I love all the little asides and stories that are in there. Like, I cannot get over the story of Don Drummond, and I've known Don Drummond's work. I mean, I have many albums with songs that he has written, but his story is unbelievable. Like,
it is. I could write a book about that, and I would love to write a biography on Don Drummond.
Yeah.
Genius, an absolute genius, and there's a fine line between genius and insanity.
Really? Yeah, but this guy was a tortured soul. It just seemed that
he was. Yeah, he was. He was. I think today, he'd be medicated and he'd be fine. He was diagnosed as schizophrenic and he self-medicated and didn't always medicate like he should. And his girlfriend Margarita, who was a dancer, she knew that his medication that he took would make him sleepy, so he didn't want her to go out and dance one night. She gave his medicine to him late, and he ended up sleeping right through a Skatalites gig. When he woke up, he had missed the gig. He found out that she had gone out dancing. He was not happy, and an argument ensued, and he ended up killing her. He ended up stabbing her, and so he was found guilty of murder because he went right down to the police station himself and then was committed to a mental institution and 4 years later died. And so some of the Skatalites that I talked to weigh in on what they think happened, because there's some kind of mystery surrounding that as well.
It's a fascinating story, and you're sitting there, you're going, okay, this is the guy, he's written hundreds of these ska classics, and
Eastern Standard Time and Man on the Street, and he was very prolific, and he was a Rasta, and he would go to Kaunasi's Rasta camp in the hills and have these, huge day-long jam sessions, and really honed his skills after studying at Alpha Boys School, like so many of these ska artists did. They were trained jazz musicians. But he went to the hills, and he honed his skills. He mentored Rico Rodriguez.
Yeah, I didn't know that, and I guess it makes total sense, reading that now, but just fascinating the mystery surrounding his death while he was committed to the mental institution. So it's like lots of ups, lots of downs, an interesting story. And I mean,
Scott history is full of that. Scott history is full of these interesting stories like that, where you're like, wow, that's because it was another time, another world. And when we talk about Rude Boys, we have no idea. We have no idea, because it's a novelty. It's kind of a novelty. To us, a Rude Boy is, the guy you see at the show who's skanking, who's all decked out. That is not what it was. It was a real bad gangster who killed and murdered, murdered people, raped people. It was not good. And so, there's some real stories, like Derek Morgan tells me, real stories of real Rude Boys, and it's shocking.
Yeah, I mean, it's like if a hyper aggressive Tony Soprano was really into reggae music or ska music, you know?
Right, right, right. Yeah, like 200 pounds less, probably. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, these are cultures that we as like Americans, and you know, you're from the Midwest too. It's like we don't.
Yeah.
We just. It's totally a foreign concept, so I love that those stories come to life in this book.
Well, thanks. And I think when you hear it from the people themselves, like I put it in the book, you know, they're quoted. The story is, I didn't, you know, change the words at all. When you hear it that way, that's how it becomes real, you know, because you may have heard what a rude boy was. You know, rude boy was a gangster in 1965 or whatever. You right. may have heard that, but when you hear the real story, that's when it, like you say, becomes real.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing is the grammar. I mean, everything is exactly as you would imagine. I mean, you can tell this is direct from the source. I mean, the colloquialisms, the different expressions, it just makes the whole thing very, very interesting, you know?
You know, and that kind of brings up an interesting point to me. I mean, I had kind of, I'm glad you say that, because I had battled with that as a writer, is I've noticed when I've read some other books on reggae and stuff, you know, they've left in the Jamaican patois so that, you know, instead of this, you get this, and, you know, all of that, and boy, you know, BW, AI and things like that, you know, and I thought, am I going to do that? And I decided not to leave the Jamaican patois in there unless it was important.
Right.
You know, unless the word was integral to the meaning of the sentence. But otherwise, it wouldn't have been readable. I mean, I had a hard time interpreting. So I had to play things over 25 times to understand what is Lloyd Brevet saying. Because first of all, he's speaking in thick patois. He's probably doing it on purpose, because I've heard that too. They like to, like, you know, play with you.
Sure.
And then also, he's speaking so quiet and so calm, and I mean, it lulls you, his voice. But I didn't want to get rid of, like you say, the grammar. You know, Derek Morgan, I mean, he doesn't, you know, he omits words that we would maybe put in and things like that. So I did try to keep it as true to form as I could without detracting from the text.
Was the language barrier, because it is really kind of a different language. Was that tough to overcome? Did you have to burn a lot of calories going sifting through all those tapes?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. There were, like I said, I mean, thank goodness for those rewind and fast forward buttons on my little micro cassette, because it was rough. There were times when I thought about just going ... because I couldn't understand what they were saying, but then I would put it aside and I would come back to it, you know, a lot later, and I was like, oh, okay, that's what he's saying. When I first started listening to these back in 96, when they first started talking to me, that I understood less than what I understood now, just because I've read so much, I've researched so much, that then I would know what they were saying too.
Well, and that was what I was going to ask you is, you know, during this very long project over the course of time here, what did you learn? I mean, you must have learned a ton of different things about the music, you know, over time.
Yeah. I did, and a lot came out between now and then. Certainly with the two-tone stuff, I was able to find a lot of old articles from New Music Express and a lot of these old newspapers that they put out in England. So I found a lot of archived original articles from back in the day. So that was very helpful. And then, too, you know, like, Neville Staple, he's since written his book, Original Rude Boy. Sorry, note my, I don't know if my tone comes across there, but I'm a little skeptical of his original claim. And then Horace Panter came out with his, and there have been a lot, you know, quite a few kind of two-tone books that have come out. Reading all those really was helpful. And then that way I could go back to a lot of the artists when I would re-interview them, or some of them I just kept an open dialogue with, like Roddy Radiation and Lee Thompson from Madness and Roddy Radiation from the Specials. I emailed those guys, weekly, just asking them questions as I was reading stuff coming, that would just come to me, and that would help really clarify the text too. With the Jamaican stuff, not so much. I feel like with those guys, it was a one-shot deal.
Right.
I didn't really re-interview any of them, except Toots Hibbert. When I interviewed him, then I would ask any clarification questions through his manager, just because, I was honored enough to have been given that opportunity. But with the Two Tone guys, they were very, if you ever need anything, give me an shoot me an email or let me know or call me again. And Pauline Black, the most generous, sweet woman, and very open dialogue with her. And so I was able to go back a few times and clarify things. It was nice.
Well, it's really great that you had the opportunity to hit these people up, in this time in their lives, because I think they realize their contribution to music was substantial.
Yeah.
And I think they want their story to be heard. And so it's tough to go dig back into the 60s and talk to the original founders of that of traditional ska, but the Two Tone people, I'm sure,
right.
now they're becoming a lot more forthcoming. And
they are. And now they've got the 30th anniversary coming, that's just come and gone. So there's a revival, too.
Oh, absolutely. And that's what makes some of the Two Tone chapters even more relevant, immediately in this day and age, because it was very neat to I've been seeing the Specials now popping up on late night TV, and they've got I think they have one more U.S. tour that they are planning on doing for the upcoming year, and it's just interesting then to go and read about because you document very well the sort of the butting of heads and the sort of the turmoil that happened inside of the Specials camp.
Yeah, and nobody really knew, because when you see them on Saturday Night Live playing, it looks like everything's happy and fun, and they're skanking around and jumping around, and everything seems fine, but you never realize that show, back in whenever that was, 82 or whatever, almost never happened.
Yeah, I thought that was awesome. I thought that was a phenomenal point of interest in the whole ska story.
Yeah, they hated America, the Specials. Most of them hated America back then, because they're socialists. And so they come here and they're playing in front of a backdrop of Rockefeller Center. I mean, they almost walked right there. So it was tough. And it still is. I have to admit. I mean, a lot of the guys, it's not. But for the Specials, I mean, you'll notice on the U.S. tour, and you'll find out why in my book. But Neville Staple won't be with them.
That's right.
He won't be with them, unfortunately.
Yeah.
He's a great presence on stage. He's a lot of fun, a lot of energy. And I saw him at the last show that they played in Chicago, where the scene went down that prevents his return. And, it's a shame, because he's a great performer. And but he does tour with them over in the U.K., and is seeing a wide, fan, the fans are as strong as ever. They're just older and heavier, and that's all.
So. Yeah, exactly. And what I also think was interesting, because, I'm very familiar with their music, and I've seen some of the classic footage of them, and now to see them, nowadays, it just warms my heart. But what I didn't realize is, and you point out in the book about what they were all about, and like the fact that there wasn't a line between crowd and band. They wanted to be on the same page as everyone. And I also love when you're talking about Terry Hall's deadpan performance, and how that it was carried over from his previous punk band that he had started. And that was something I just was like, wow, this guy seems like he just could care less about being on stage.
Right.
I thought maybe he had an issue.
You hear the song so many times and you sing along with them that they almost have no meaning anymore. It's just kind of like a, it's a sing-along.
Right.
But then when you read, I tried to describe his deadpan staring, you know, and then his it's kind of a monotone singing, you know, like hitting one note, not moving from that note, not wavering, and then moving to the next note. And, you know, that was a punk thing, and that was that era of punk. We can, you know, punk has, you know, what does that even mean anymore?
Right.
But when you think of it in those terms, I mean, it really was a different thing than anybody had ever seen before.
Yeah, it was a bit of rebellion, a bit of discord, you know.
Yep.
And to me, it was like, you know, from Joe Schmo in the stands, you know, 20 years later, looking at it, it's like, huh, it just looks like he's, you know, he's got a bug up his ass and would rather
that's
be somewhere else.
That's what he wanted you to think, I bet, too. I love it, you know? He wanted you to think that he didn't care.
Well, and it is interesting because it is in such like contrast to everyone
yep.
else in the band, because everyone else in the band
going
is
bonkers.
Going crazy.
Yeah, they're pogoing all over, and they're going, yeah, especially Neville and Linval, they're going crazy. And Jerry Dammers, he's just crazy by himself, so
right.
with his teeth missing and everything, and so, yeah, and of course he won't be touring with them. That was disappointing, I think, to all the fans and everything, but Roddy said, you know, that they weren't surprised, and that was just, you know, something that, you know, that's just Jerry. Anybody knows, you know, there's another case of a person who's a genius, who's just, he's kind of a curmudgeon
right,
now,
right.
you know, my way or the highway. And Roddy and him, yeah, they always got into it, and they still do. In fact, I even, when I was trying to get rights to some of the songs, because for every song lyric I put in there, you know, you have to have licensing rights, and I had written a whole bunch of song lyrics to demonstrate the stuff I'm talking about in the specials chapter, and had to get permission from Jerry Dammers, because he's the one that wrote the songs,
mm-hmm.
and got about a 4-page letter sent through his manager on email from Jerry, because I had to show how the songs were being used, and the 4-page letter was just a blow-by-blow of why Roddy was wrong on this account, wrong on this account, wrong on this account. So he just disagreed with everything that Roddy said in the chapter, and he wouldn't let me use the lyrics because of that. So they're still pretty feisty.
Well, it's funny, and the fact that I thought this was another interesting anecdote regarding Elvis Costello's term as their producer for their debut album, and how
right.
Roddy and Jerry's butting of heads really led to him
yep.
not wanting to have much to do with the specials. So
Elvis Costello already said, you know, I think that Roddy's word is sack. You know, that's such a British term. You know, he wanted to sack me.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you know, get rid of this Roddy guy. He's no good, you know. He didn't want Roddy in the band. It's just so funny because Roddy's, you know, classic, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Classic, that rockabilly edge. But
I love that. Elvis Costello just didn't get what we were trying to do. And
I love it. Yeah, isn't that great?
But I wonder what
Elvis's take would be.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, the personal touches like that, you don't really get anywhere else. And that's really what I think is a great value to the book.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I think, like, you know, like I started my book, everybody has a story to tell. You know, everybody
right.
has their own story to tell. And that's history. You know, every time you read anything, it is somebody's story they are telling. And so that's what I wanted to do, is present all of these different versions, and then you be the judge.
Yeah, I definitely dig that. Now, Heather, I know that you are a passionate person about ska, and that is totally evident. So I want to float this theory that King Django just was he was on the show a couple weeks ago.
I saw that. It's very cool.
Yeah, and he brought up a theory about traditional ska, early reggae, but also two-tone. And he had actually cited the specials and said that whole album, each song was like a life lesson or a particular value. And he talked about value-based music. Would you agree that there were more values in this genre, especially back then?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I mean, I think one of the arguments that I try to make, hopefully, is that, you know, and I think it was Dave Wakeling who said it, but he said, you know, it's this upbeat music. You know, if you listen to the words, they're singing about, you know, a a baby not being given the same advantages of everybody else because they live in the ghetto and they don't have enough to eat and the poverty and all that. But yet it's delivered with this upbeat tone. And in Jamaica, you know, the politics of the time is, you know, completely oppressive, even though there's independence that happens. That's, you know, there's no independence for the common person. And that's the stuff they're singing about, largely. And then the same thing happened with Two Tone. I definitely have to agree with them because, you know, you listen to, like, Ghost Town. I mean, they're talking about the riots that are happening because of Margaret Thatcher's economics. And, you know, the guys that formed these bands, they were, you know, disenfranchised, white, blue-collar kids who couldn't find a job. The unemployment rate was like 14%. Hey, maybe it's a pretty good time for more ska right now.
Well, and that kind of leads me to my next point. And I think towards the end of the book, you had a chance to talk to Bucket from the Toasters. And he makes a similar point, and I don't know exactly the words that he used, but, you know, once again, ska was pushed back into the underground.
The underground, yeah.
And how now, even though we don't have, you know, bands that are out there, they don't have the means to tour, or they don't have the means to do all these things, but they do have the passion and they do have the creative talent to really craft some really, really great music. And I've kind of witnessed that over the past, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years, and I see these bands starting to pop up now.
Right.
The economic times here in America are pretty subpar. So it's like it's almost you start to see maybe some of the formings of a new sort of resurgence of I don't want to use the word wave, but a resurgence maybe of the
I never use those terms in my book, but because they're difficult. I think they're difficult. But yeah, I agree. I agree. I think that, you know, there's some great new bands that are coming up. You know, Green Room Rockers, they're awesome. And then some of the same bands that have been touring for a while, like Hepcat and, you know, Scofflaws and Slackers. And I mean, these guys are great. And it's not just like a resurgence. It's not like a reunion tour.
Right.
You know, these guys have been doing it for a long time. And then there's still these new great bands that are coming out. And like you say, it is talent. I think one of the reasons why, as I talked about in that last chapter, that ska kind of died down for a while after the 90s was there were just too many bands out there. You know, there was everybody who had a high school band, you know, was in marching band, then, you know, they put together a ska band. And so you have 5 bands on a bill on any Saturday night, and they were all kind of mediocre, but you could go and have a great time. And but was that your favorite band? You know, it's Isaac Green from The Scholars talks about that. He said, you know, it has to be somebody's favorite band. It has to be somebody's favorite song for it to last. And, you know, some of those bands have stuck around. And, you know, Fishbone, when they still play, I mean, you still go, you know, hear Boning in the Graveyard. And, you know, it's great stuff because those are the great songs. But, you know, can you name any of the other bands that have come and gone? And, you know, I think that it's because there's got to be some meat to it. A lot of the stuff that Fishbone wrote was political, you know, a lot of, not all of it, some of it was just, you know, fun, crazy crap, but, but, you know, a lot of it, you know, especially now too, with all the issues of race that have come to the forefront, you know, it's a good time again.
Yeah,
so.
Absolutely. Yeah. The culture is right. Ska has always been, you know, sort of the music of the people and, you know, people, against the struggles of society. So I think that we definitely see a lot of that, those themes kind of popping its head up again, especially here in America. But now, I don't know. I agree. I think that the band, like the market, was kind of saturated in the late 90s, and you had more of the mediocre, crappy bands were outnumbering some of these, you know, great bands. And it's funny. Then once the bubble popped, all of the great bands stuck around, or, you know, are still there. And then it was basically a separate. It wasn't so much of the music collapsed. I felt like it was more of a separation of the wheat from the chaff, you know.
Exactly. I love that expression. That's very true. Yeah, it's very true. And I think I can't remember who it was that I had interviewed. I think maybe it was I don't know, but one, I would think it was a guy from the ska club, but he was saying, you know, all those crappy bands were great for us because now they're gone and we're left and the fans are still there. People still love ska.
Right.
And so, yeah, it was Jason Nugent from the Slackers.
Oh, right.
Yeah, he said a lot of ska bands really sucked, is what he says. Not to say that we're better than them, but a lot of them just really drew weak influences and copied what everybody else was doing. They don't have the tradition in it.
Right.
So, and you know, I
think, well, I think that, like, Bucket, when I was, he was on the show earlier this year, and...
awesome.
You know, it's what warms my heart about people like him are that he is so optimistic, even though he's, you know, he's ridden through those bad times and, you know, arguably,
oh, yeah.
You know, like the industry is, you know, he's not seeing a giant payday because of his, you know, because of his work and his music.
No,
and, but he's
not.
But he's still optimistic.
I know. Isn't it amazing for a New Yorker?
Right.
I mean, he's not really a New Yorker, but he lived in New York long enough to be called a New Yorker. It's amazing. And he had some really bad stuff happen to him. You find out about, in my book here, he talks about the demise of Moon. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a, you know, a convergence of a couple of different factors, but he could be really bitter if he wanted to be. But he's not. And he when he says that Scott's back in the underground, he's pretty happy about that. I think he's happy because then he knows it's kind of simmering. And that the cream of the crop is kind of coming out right now.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And he's learned a lot. He's learned a lot from what went wrong at Moon. And now with his new label, Megalith, he's not doing the same things. He's not keeping, you know, a stock of 5,000, you know, CDs that are, you know, compilations around his apartment and mailing them out. He's not doing that anymore. So it's a different game now.
Oh yeah, the game has totally changed. He's still got the good heart, and he's, you know, kind of, he's learned the mistakes. And I'm excited. I'll get to talk to him in a couple months when the Toasters are back on tour and they're going to be coming through Minneapolis. So that'll be good.
He's so great, and what that guy has done for ska. I mean, I don't know. It wouldn't be the same without him. That's for sure. I don't even know if you know. It definitely would not be the same in America because he's the one that when he came here from England back in whatever 84-ish, and he saw, you know, English Beat was not getting the crowds that they should. He's the one that said, instead of like kicking the dirt and being like, you know, oh, this is wrong, this is crappy, and being all angry about it. He said, you know what? I'm gonna DIY, put together my own band. And show these people, you know, what ska's all about. And then when nobody would pick up his record, he said, okay, fine, I'm going to start my own label. And this guy's amazing.
Yeah.
Talk about optimistic, yeah. And he puts it to good use, you know. He employs it. He doesn't just speak it.
Well, it's interesting because he's the type of person that inspires a Heather Augustine to put together, you know, like,
yeah.
you see out there, okay, well, there's all these, you know, the ska history that isn't being told. I want to put these, you know, these stories together into one place so that people can, you know, for generations can read this.
Right.
And he's also the type of person to inspire me to do the same, only in audio form. And
right.
I mean, it's the reason why I do my show. I want the people that are still ska fans or generate new ska fans and let them know about what's going on in their own country right now. So
right. And you know, none of that is more present than when you go to a show. And everybody, that was the thing, when I went to my first ska show, I was hooked because you go and it is like no other. Everybody is brother and sister. Everybody is dancing. What the heck? That is so awesome to see everybody having the greatest time singing along, strangers.
Right.
It is so much fun. And then going up on the stage too, in true special style, no barrier between the audience and the stage, and the Toasters do that every time. It's a beautiful thing. So
yeah, absolutely. Why is it that, like, because I think we all, a lot of us have a similar experience. I know I went to my first, you know, all ages show down in at the Warehouse in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and I saw, you know, some of the bands from my high school, but it didn't matter, like, that they were just, you know, local bands. Everyone was having a good time. Someone got knocked down. Someone was picking them up. And, you know, you could go and sing on stage with the band. It's like,
I know,
you know, it was like some sort of like Wonderland, you know, for, you're like, wow, and no parents in sight, you know, like,
I know.
And
now there's parents and their kids coming to the same ska show, so that's awesome.
Right, and that's cool in its own respect. I think that's really cool, and I don't know if all of us are just trying to chase that feeling, or if the music. I mean, I just think that the music is that powerful, and
I think it is too, because that's how it was since day one. I mean, it was an escape. Everybody works hard all week long. It was escape since day one, you know, and they would go out to the sound system dances out in a big, you know, empty field with the big speakers, the Houses of Joy. They were going there to escape. And in Two-Tone, they were going to escape after, you know, unemployment or after working hard in the car factories. They were going to escape. And I think we do the same thing. We're just lucky that we're not in the same depravity that our predecessors were, but it's still an escape.
Yeah, absolutely, and I don't know. It feels good to speak with you, Heather, because I feel like it's, you know, someone who, like, there are many, many like you that just get it, and so it's refreshing to have these sort of conversations and keep the dialogue going and keep people going out and, you know, and supporting the music in no matter how they can, whether it's going to shows, starting a band, or hey, writing a book.
Right. right, or just listening. Yep.
So
thanks.
Now I've got the book in my hand. I will be writing a review, so stay tuned to the FancyPantsGangsters.com site. I will be having a review of it up rather shortly. But where and when can people get a hold of this?
People can buy it right now, and it is you can get it on Amazon, you can get it on BarnesandNoble.com. Or you can get one off of my website if you would like to get more information about it, find out exactly who's in it, see some of the reviews that people have written, like Roddy Radiation, Trojan Records has done a review, the Jamaica Gleaners done a review. So you can check all that out at skabook.com. It's skabook, skabook.com.
Cool. Yeah, we will definitely feature that link in the show notes. So, if you... Now that you've heard all about this awesome book, and I do think it's great. It was a very easy read, but I felt like I learned a ton. So
well, thank you.
and even if you're an expert out there and you think that you know everything, there's some stuff in here that you will find quite interesting.
Well, thank you so much, Courtney. I really appreciate it. It was fun.
Yeah, and thanks a lot for taking the time to talk with me. Hopefully, I'll be in your neck of the woods, maybe to catch a Green Room Rockers show or something.
That sounds good. I'll buy you a Pabst.
Excellent. All right. For Heather Augustine and Ska in Oral History in bookstores now, I've been Courtney Close. So we're all saying skank on.
Mm-hmm.